long time for many a green activist, even just talking about how society might adapt to climate change was taboo conversation at the environmental dinner table. It felt like giving up on combating climate change and all those efforts to reduce greenhouse gases said to be the cause. But now, with example after example of calamitous weather, from extreme drought and heat to raging floods to a winter so warm we wore flip-flops in March, many are now saying, let's talk about adaptation. Let's look at how our state, our towns, our homes might be better prepared for these crazy weather events, which we are told are the new normal. That means anything from farmers planting more drought-resistant seeds to communities building bridges higher above rivers in anticipation of more powerful floods to coastal homeowners changing their insurance policies. And for many New Englanders, it may also require a psychological, even spiritual shift as we realize that our seasons, our landscape, and the traditions that go along with them won't be the same. Today in The Exchange, climate adaptation, what it means, and whether it's an admission of defeat, an excuse to give up. Let's hear from you. What are some of the practical ways you see your community trying to adapt to coming climate change? Are you seeing changes already in building codes or farming practices and so forth? And how do you feel about this bigger question? Does a focus on adaptation mean giving up on actually combating climate change? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests. Joining us from D.C. is Vicky Arroyo, Executive Director of the Georgetown Climate Center of the Georgetown University Law Center, where she's also a visiting professor. And Vicky, thank you for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
So much. Great to be here.
Well, joining us in the studio is Steve Blackmer. He's worked in conservation in New Hampshire for 30 years, including for such groups as the Northern Forest Center. Steve recently received his master's degree in religion and ecology at Yale Divinity School. He works at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Concord. And Steve, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Cameron Wake, a research associate professor at the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at UNH, and author of a new environmental benchmark report from UNH. And Cameron, welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for inviting me, Laura.
Well, there's so much, folks, to talk about what adaptation means, how we feel about it. But just before we get into that, let's take a minute, Cameron, to talk about the weather we've seen. Thankfully, it hasn't been too bad in New England this summer, but the droughts and heat waves elsewhere have been devastating. Can we, Cameron, definitively link this to greenhouse gas buildup in the atmosphere causing climate change?
Yes, we can. One of the things we always say in the science community is for any particular event, it's hard to point to it and say that is the result of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. But when you look at all the events that have occurred across the region, across the nation, and across the globe, what we're seeing in terms of more droughts and more floods and intensification of hurricanes is something that the scientific community has been predicting now for the last 20 years. So it is entirely consistent with a vision that we've laid out on the issue of human-driven climate change. And so not only have we seen a whole set of those changes in terms of extreme weather becoming the new normal, we should expect to continue to see an intensification of many of these events.
So that's why we call it climate change instead of global warming, because the climate, it could be in some places cooler than it used to be, in Europe, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the important point here is that if it's a little bit warmer or a little bit cooler on average, people are going to be able to deal with that. But along with this human-induced global warming, climate change, what we're really seeing is these change in the frequency and severity of extreme events, because there's just more energy in the system now that has to be dissipated. And so, you know, across New England, we've really experienced this significant increase in really big precipitation events. And so when I go and talk to a lot of people out in communities, I don't talk to them so much about global warming. I talk to them, how did you deal with the recent flood and how are you going to deal with that flood in the future? And in that sense, this extreme weather really has become the new normal. And it's wonderful that we're going to talk about how it is our communities, municipalities, and individuals can begin to deal with adapting to this new norm.
Well, and that is the focus today. But one more super quick question for you, Cameron. Okay, every time this comes up, some people say, look, there could be weird solar activity, it could be El Nino or La Nina, or cyclical fluctuations in climate. I mean, there are still some folks who feel like, look, you don't definitively know.
So climate changes. Climate always has changed and climate always will change. What's new today is that there is an overwhelming body of scientific evidence that clearly shows that humans are the main drivers of that change. I can tell you those people that say it's just cyclical are not in the scientific community. When we go to science meetings, we understand that humans are now part of a big complex system. So the same scientists who actually discovered that there's cycles in the climate cycle or climatologists are the same scientists that are indicating today it's humans that are causing the climate to change.
Well, the head of ExxonMobil actually said recently that fossil fuel burning was warming the planet. That was huge, and that got a lot of play. I want to talk with all of you, though, about adaptation and turn to you, Vicky Arroyo. It's interesting to me that there's a whole climate center at Georgetown University looking at adaptation. What does this mean, real broadly, adaptation?
So I should say our climate center does local communities on mitigation as well, because it's obviously critical that we do reduce our emissions to climate change. But we do also have a very large focus on adaptation. We have a clearinghouse that agencies and individuals can go to and look to see in a certain sector or region what are the impacts and how can they adapt. And what it basically means is coping. As Cameron said, we're already seeing these changes, and they're coming sort of fast and furious. We're breaking records at a record-breaking pace, if you will. And so we really need to understand that the future is going to look different than the past, when we've really had relatively stable conditions for many, many years. And so we have to change our lives accordingly, change our investments. If we're, you know, building new roads or bridges, build them differently, maybe with different materials, maybe build bridges higher. Maybe do as they're doing in Vermont with some of the rebuilding after Hurricane Irene, and not channel the water so much so that it becomes this raging torrent that takes out the bridge, but try to really reinstate some of the floodplains that allows that water to sort of take some of the pressure off the channel. So we can be smarter, and we can adapt, and we can cope. People can adapt, and ecosystems can. Unfortunately, it's just happening so quickly that it's challenging, and it's even more challenging for the natural environment than it is for people, obviously.
So change our public investments, our roads, our bridges, maybe having more absorbent pavement or more green space so that it'll suck up water and water won't rush off so quickly. What else, Vicky? I'm real interested in these sort of practical changes that we need to make as we adapt.
So one of the toolkits that we've developed that's about to come out is on reducing the impacts of urban heat. So there's urban heat island effect, so it actually exacerbates the warming that we're seeing on average in our urban areas. And so we're working with communities like D.C., where our center is based, to look at tools like white roofs, just painting roofs white so they're more reflective, green roofs, adding vegetation to the roof, permeable pavements, as you mentioned, to deal with some of that stormwater runoff that Cameron also mentioned. And what's interesting about D.C.'s approach, and they became the leader last year in the new green roofs installed last year, and that was funded in part through a 5-cent tax on plastic bags. So, you know, these bags are not ending up in the river, but if you get them and you pay the 5 cents, at least you know that it's going to a good cause, because it's enabling home and building owners to install green roofs with the help of the D.C. government.
Okay, so if cities, Vicky, are going to get especially hot as the climate warms up and you got all that concrete, one, again, very easy, practical thing to do is either paint a roof white or put some grass and trees on top.
That's right. Or even add trees to your neighborhood. Urban forest canopy makes a difference as well.
Right. We all know that, walking down a hot street and suddenly you get on a shady one. And boy, it's a relief. You know, Steve Blackmer, we've been talking about practical applications, and we'll talk a lot more about that. But I want to ask you about the spiritual shift that we're going to have to go through. For some people, there's a sense of loss to this realization that spring, summer, winter, fall aren't going to be the same.
Yeah, there's a tremendous sense of loss. I want to tell a story about a 12-year-old boy who used to love to ice skate. And down at the end of the road where he grew up, there was a swamp, what we called a swamp then, a marshland. Go skating up the stream and out to a little pond and play pond hockey out there. There came a point, this was a number of years ago, when the road builders were going to build a road through that swamp and destroy it. The loss, the sense of loss of that loved place and that loved activity, playing pond hockey on the swamp, motivated a 12-year-old boy to write his first letter to the editor about...
Was that you?
That was me. That was me. Some while ago. But it was the sense first of love and then of loss that that motivated action. And my, I think what we, in order to find the strength to take the action that's going to be required on massive scales to respond to climate change, we have to tap into first that sense of love. What are these things that we love that we care about? And then to recognize the sense of sadness that is within us as we lose them. And I think it's in those kinds of ways that we can find, again, we can find the hope, the motivation to do what's going to be some very, very difficult stuff.
Well, here's the thing, though, Steve. I mean, you know, I have two little boys who love to skate on the pond near where we live. And boy, there was very little skating to be done this past winter. How do you talk about that? How do you talk about that in a way that doesn't just completely depress these children, that their future is going to be, you know, quite different from what yours had, what your past had been and what their past
had been? The first thing is simply to acknowledge it, to say, this makes me sad. To bring that forward, not to hide it, this makes me sad that the world is a place that's filled with loss and that what we're experiencing is sadness, and then to turn their attention to, but what's beautiful in the world? What even in the face of that change is beautiful? And this was a practice that I developed myself many years ago, working in conservation, constantly facing the sense of loss of pieces of land that I loved. And I deliberately, consciously made a practice every day of looking for things that were beautiful.
That slushy pond is beautiful.
It is still beautiful. A hazy, you know, carbon-filled, sulfur-filled atmosphere can still be beautiful. So just it's a really difficult process of understanding that and saying, I can't stop this, but I can do some things. I can take action. And first of all is to say, there are things that I love in this world. There are things of beauty in this world. And to affirm that and to use that as the springboard for hope.
Well, Cameron, The Economist magazine called talking about adaptation the equivalent of making rude noises at a dinner party. I mean, for a long time, seems to me, environmentalists didn't even want to talk about adaptation because that seems like, well, it's coming. Let's adapt and give up.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And the adaptation conversation has really come to the front society-wide over the course of the past 5 to 6 years.
How about you personally?
Well, the scientific community has always identified the way that we are going to deal with climate change as two parallel efforts, one on mitigation and one on adaptation. And it's really important here that we eliminate, so that we change the tyranny of the or for the opportunity of the and. Yeah. We have to do both. You cannot deal with the issue of climate change by solely doing mitigation or solely doing adaptation. They are fundamentally linked. And here's why. If we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, we can reduce the amount of climate change that we need to adapt to. And so the front line in adaptation is really reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And then we have to adapt to the climate change that we've already committed to, not only that we're seeing today, but over the course of the next 40 or 50 years, because the carbon dioxide I emitted when I drove here today is going to be in the atmosphere for over 100 years. So it really is a parallel track that we've been talking about in the scientific community for two decades, but one that's really come to the front sort of society-wide recently.
All right. Lots to talk about after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls, so stay with us.
I think that the intelligence of the programs is riveting, honestly. There is even ones that I feel like possibly aren't really going to be that interesting to me. I'm still drawn into them by the points of view that are brought forth because it's very balanced. I'm not only drawn to the balance, but I'm drawn to the depth that most often is really explored. Everything really makes me think, challenges some of my preconceptions, and I feel like I grow and I learn by listening to The Exchange. My name is Lynn Krikorian. I'm from Manchester, and I am a sustaining member of NHPR.
And it is a real dialogue on The Exchange. It is not soundbite journalism. Hi, welcome to NHPR's Summer Car Raffle. I am Rick Ganley, host of Morning Edition here on New Hampshire Public Radio, joined by our program director, Abby Goldstein. We want to get you a raffle ticket today so that you can be part of our early bird portion of our car raffle. Give us a call right now, 1-888 1-888-805-6477. Help support NHPR and be entered to win some great prizes. 1-888-805-6477.
Or online, nhpr.org. And it is time again for our summer car raffle. Our grand prize is a brand new car. You can choose either a Ford Fusion Hybrid or a Toyota Prius, donated in part by Grapponi Automotive Group. Second prize is a bicycle and a roof rack from S&W Sports in Concord. And third prize is a kayak donated by Portsmouth Kayak Adventures. But the reason to call right now, before this Saturday, is that you're running out of time to be the winner of our early bird raffle prize, which is $2,000 in gas gift cards from Irving Oil. So we want you to get in on this today, now, 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org so you don't miss out on the early bird prize.
We know that listening to The Exchange is part of your daily routine. We're not going to interrupt that for more than a couple of minutes here, but we do want to ask you to just interrupt your routine for just a minute and give us a call and get that raffle ticket. As Abby said, we're down to mere hours here. This is Saturday at noon. This isn't like our usual car raffles. This isn't like our usual fundraising where you have several days to think about it a little bit and procrastinate. You got to get right to it. Give us a call right now. Jump out of your routine for just a couple of minutes. It's very quick. It's very easy. 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
And it's really interesting listening to this conversation on adaptation to climate change. And this is what The Exchange does so well, offering a multitude of different perspectives on a topic that sometimes challenge your assumptions. Maybe this is giving you some food for thought and certainly helping you become better informed. Your purchase of a $50 raffle ticket or three or four raffle tickets helps us produce the programming that you rely on a daily basis. So make that call right now, buy your raffle ticket, and help us continue to bring you these compelling conversations and to help deliver that food for thought. 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
You really can't delay. This is a little different, as I said, than our usual fundraising. You know, this is really brief. This is really fun. We love doing the car raffle here at NHPR because there are a lot of great prizes. The early bird portion is very exciting because you just have a few hours to get in, get those raffle tickets, and get that $2,000 in gas gift cards. You can't do it if you don't get in it, so give us a call right now. You'd only have mere hours. 1-888-805-6477. 1-888-805-6477.
NHPR.org. Noon this Saturday is the deadline to get entered to win the early bird prize, $2,000 in gas gift cards. We're going to announce our early bird winner the following Saturday, August 11th, during Car Talk. So you can tune in then and hope to hear your name announced on the air. In the meantime, you can't win it if you're not in it. 1-888-805-6477 is the number to call. You can see all the prizes, read our rules and regulations, and get your raffle tickets online, nhpr.org. And good luck.
This is NHPR. Checking New Hampshire weather for today. Partly sunny and warm. Chance of an afternoon thunderstorm. Highs today, 85 to 90 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy and humid. Lows in the 60s. Tomorrow, mix of clouds and sunshine. Chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm. Highs 85 to 90. It'll be partly sunny Saturday. Highs 87 to 92 degrees. And on Sunday, mostly sunny, hot, humid. Highs 85 to 90 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Art of the Americas Wing at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, where America's treasures bring history to life. More at mfa.org. And from UNH Manchester, inviting first-year and transfer students to explore programs beginning this fall at UNH's campus in Manchester. manchester.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, adapting to climate change and the weather effects, we're told, could be the new normal. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. What are some of the practical ways you see your city or town trying to adapt to climate change? Are you seeing or thinking about changes in building codes, farming practices, insurance policies, and so forth? Also, given limited resources, does adaptation mean giving up on efforts to combat climate change, to reduce its effects? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or post your comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests: Cameron Wake, a research associate professor at the Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space at UNH; Steve Blackmer, a longtime conservation professional in New Hampshire. He recently received his master's in religion and ecology at Yale Divinity School and has been working on these issues of climate change and adaptation. Joining us from D.C., Vicky Arroyo, executive director of the Georgetown Climate Center. And Vicky, to you real quickly before we go to our listeners. We were tossing around this idea before the break of adaptation. Does it mean giving up? Does it mean, okay, it's changing, it's so big, I can't stop it, so I'm not even going to bother riding my bike to work?
Well, that might be tempting, but the truth is that if we can't get a handle on our emissions, it will really be nearly impossible to adapt. I mean, I think those of us who work very hard on adaptation realize that you really have to do both, and you have to really work hard on both now in this time period. So, you know, the idea of some of the methods that we're talking about, you know, green roofs making a difference in urban areas or building seawalls, I mean, all of this obviously assumes a certain amount of warming and a certain amount of sea level rise, for example, in a certain amount of time. And if we really reach some thresholds, which, of course, Cameron can speak to regarding some of the ice dynamics, you know, we're going to have much higher levels of sea level rise and much more dislocation of the people who live around the coast all along around the world. So we clearly have to redouble our efforts to get our leaders to reduce emissions as well.
I wonder, though, if talk, Vicky, of adaptation to, you know, the already existing problems that we see discourages people who aren't, you know, active in the field like you are. It just seems so big, you can't really do anything about it.
But the thing is that we're seeing these things, and I think, like you're experiencing, and like the other speakers are experiencing, in their own backyards, literally. And so, you know, it's really hard to ignore, and I do think that it's really calling on people to say, what can we do about it? And the good news, if there is any here, is that there are things you can do. There are things that you can do personally in your own life, both on the, you know, energy side to try to move to cleaner practices, be more efficient. But there's also things that you can do in your own community to help to promote adaptation in a smart way and to raise this issue with your leaders. It might actually be an opportunity to get your leaders to care more about mitigating climate change when they really hear the costs that are involved with stepping up and adapting to these unavoidable consequences.
What do you think about that, Cameron?
I think it's a really important point, and I would like to emphasize that we don't really have a choice in ignoring this. We are going to have to deal with this, and if we deal with it now and we plan correctly, we will actually significantly limit the negative impacts of these events in the future. If we wait 10 to 20 years, we're not only going to have to pay for those all the damage that occurs, but we're going to be no farther ahead when there's a whole series of more extreme weather events. So I think Vicky has a really important point. We actually have to do both right now. And fundamentally, it's going to be really good for our economy if we do it, because we're going to reduce the amount that we expend on these natural disasters. And we're also going to improve our energy security by reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, which means becoming more energy efficient and developing more homegrown sources of energy. So is it a challenge? Absolutely, but it's one that's going to be really good for this country. And I would argue this country is at its best when faced with a huge challenge. We just need to get everybody on the same page and working in the same direction on this issue.
I don't know if everybody is on the same page that this is really a problem.
We're not. And unfortunately, it has become a significant political issue. I'm sure you'll recall when John McCain was here 8 years ago and 4 years ago, he was a firm believer in addressing the issue of global warming and climate change. And now he is not. And so we need to turn that dynamic around and realize that this is really about the health and welfare of our citizens. And we might have some very different views on how we go about solving the problem, but we need to acknowledge there's a problem that needs to be solved.
So you can't adapt until you admit. I wonder, though, about the weather events and whether, pardon the pun, whether they are starting to make at least local people say, this is crazy. We need to build our roads differently. We need to build our parking lots differently. We need to not give people building permits to build in the floodplain.
I've certainly seen that locally, and especially on the side of emergency managers who have now had to deal with these big flooding events. They don't care if it's climate change or not. They're there to help protect the health and safety of their citizens, and they realize that that they need to act. And nationally, what we've seen is a turnaround in the polls in not only the number of people that believe that climate's changing, but actually that humans are driving it, in a big part because of all the extreme weather events and fires and droughts and tornadoes that we've seen across the country.
Well, here's an email that I'll share with you, and then we'll go to our callers at 1-800-892-6477. This is from Ben. He says, our society needs to drastically lower our carbon output if we want to avoid further destabilization of our world ecosystem. But Ben says, there is a lack of political will to do this because politicians realize such changes would be very unpopular. Ben asks, and I'll throw this to you, Steve Blackmer, do your guests think that we will need to experience more drastic weather changes before there will be a public outcry for politicians across the political spectrum to act? What do you think, Steve?
I'm afraid the short answer is yes, but let me respond at greater length. I talked earlier about a 12-year-old boy. Let me imagine another boy. This one's a boy genius who's cooking away in his laboratory. You can imagine all the test tubes and the arcs of sparks flying, and he's out to create a monster. And he the monster comes into life and begins harming the world. What's his first reaction? His first reaction is to say, what monster? I don't see a monster. The second reaction when the damage continues is, I didn't make that monster. I didn't do that. And then the next reaction after that was, and anyway, even if I did create that monster, it's a good monster. Only then, when you finally begin to recognize that, in fact, it is a monster, and that the monster that was created is a reflection of who we are, then do you begin to have the adaptation. We're still at that stage of saying, as a society, what monster? Or, geez, I didn't create that monster. We're only just beginning to wake up to the fact that the monster is us, that we've actually created this monster. And only when we come to grips with that, which I'm afraid will take more severe events, can we begin to grasp the fact that, in fact, we're the ones who have to change.
Let's take some calls and some more emails. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email again is exchange@nhpr.org. Ben, thanks for that one. Let's go to Josh in Berlin. Hi, Josh, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura, and hello to your guests. I'd like to just make the point that, you know, China and India are building like two coal-powered electric plants, I think, virtually every week. And in this country, we've already torn down, due to a lot of environmentalist pressure, 250 hydroelectric dams in this country. And I'm just saying, people do have to live. And at the same time, with our technologies, this planet is sustainable, and you could increase the population. But I'm just saying, they seem to have money for wars. And they're also spraying a lot of things in that sky when you see the contrails that hang and spread out almost to cloud-side formations. And I think this is hazardous to our health, and I think we have to have a balanced approach to this global warming, because I think it's being created in some ways with a greenhouse effect, because all we have to do is see the records that are broken every year. But there's something unnatural about it, and I think the enemy isn't so much the people as it might be some of these very greedy, grasping industrialists and other ones who go where there are no environmental laws and flood our markets with slave labor goods. And that's all I'd like to say.
Well, Josh, so what does that mean for adaptation then for us here in New Hampshire? I mean, let's bring it down to our own local level. If people are greedy, as you say, and, you know, destroying the environment to reap profits, what does that mean for us here or for you in Berlin?
Well, I guess what it means is, like, we had sustainable lumber operations for over a century up here. There's no reason why the Brazilians should be basically raping that Amazon forest down there to undercut us on lumber, and it provides jobs and educational funding and everything else that we need for our future, where the children are going to develop these scientific technologies, much of which already exist. But the idea is that I think that the sun is free, as they say. You can't make money off a lot of things, and I think there are certain very high. I will say this. Al Gore has a zinc mine right on his property that routinely pollutes the riverways. It's cheaper for him to pay the fine every single month.
Yeah, so the profit motive in all this, for sure. So, and again, trying to focus the conversation on adaptation, but what do you think, Cameron? The profit motive is helping to create this. He also said something interesting. You know, what about New Hampshire's own industries? That may be a shining light for us in terms of adaptation and mitigation.
All right. Josh brought up so much, but let me try and hit three points. The first is that sure, China and India are polluting and dumping lots of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but they are not going to act until the United States takes a leadership position in this. Second, China is now becoming the leading producer in the nation of solar power and wind power. So they understand the economic drivers of this. And I think we can really learn quite a bit from them on how quickly they've turned around their industries to focus on high-tech industry and lots of jobs. And third, and I think this is a really valuable point, is that New Hampshire has long been a source of sustainable lumber and sustainable fiber for energy. And if we cut down those forests and allow those forests to regrow, they are a really important component of our adaptation mechanisms in terms of storing water and slowing runoff. And so it's really important that we continue those sustainable forestry practices so we retain those ecosystems. What we don't want to do is cut down those trees and see that land developed into more impervious surface so there's more runoff. So developing those local jobs and local economies around our ecosystems in sustainable ways is actually the future for this state.
Thanks a lot for that call, Josh. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And let's go next to Ruth in Canterbury. Hi, Ruth. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share, because just a few minutes ago, somebody was saying about, oh, what can individuals do that make a difference? And I just wanted to share that my partner and I have recently put solar panels on our home. We did both hot water and electric. And talk about homegrown energy. It doesn't get any closer to home than on your own roof. And it feels like a tiny drop in the bucket in terms of the great climate change issue. But it also feels like we are doing a little bit. And if we can inspire other people to do that, then that's great as well. But I just really want to encourage people to look into those options because, yeah, it's a little bit of money up front. But as Cameron said, we're going to pay for this in the long run. And I'd rather pay some money now and make a difference. And so it's doable. It's really exciting. We get to see a daily chart of our production, and our June electric bill was zero.
Wait, your June electric bill was zero?
Absolutely. We created enough power to cover our own needs and then also put back on the grid because we're still tied to the grid. So any extra energy we put back on the grid and we get credit for it. So right now, our neighbors are taking advantage of our solar production, and then we get credit for that. So in the wintertime, when we're not making as much, that credit will go towards our bill. So this system is designed actually to be net zero.
All right. Well,
over
Ruth,
the course
gotta,
of the year.
I've got to let you go because we're going into a break, but thank you very much for calling in. And her call raises a couple questions I have for you, Cameron and Steve and Vicky, but we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk more about adaptation when we get back.
For we New Englanders, frugality is a way of life. That salt stain on your winter jacket is a badge of honor, declaring that you have seen your share of frigid temperatures. Those tired old hiking boots that fit so well wear the many, many miles you've trekked with them. And clearly, your car has gone the distance too. NHPR's summer car raffle really speaks to this frugality. I mean, where else can you get a brand new car for $50? Go online and grab a couple of raffle tickets at nhpr.org. And if you do it today, you'll also be in the running to win $2,000 worth of Irving Oil gas gift cards. How far could you stretch those?
Well, it really is kind of a remarkable investment to buy a raffle ticket and potentially win a brand new car. Welcome to NHPR Summer Car Raffle. I'm Abby Goldstein. I'm here with Rick Ganley. This is your chance to support NHPR and get entered to win a brand new car or a bike or a kayak or our early bird prize, $2,000 in gas gift cards from Irving Oil, 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
Okay, I want you to imagine with me, Abby. Imagine that you've, well, you and I can't win, of course.
No, but we can imagine.
We can imagine. I want the listener, I want you to imagine winning those $2,000 in gas gift cards. Now, how far would that take you, $2,000 in gas? Well, Barbara Bach was the winner of our 2008 Early Bird Prize. Now, she kept half of the gas cards for herself, and then she gave the other half to her partner, and they each got about 5 months' worth of driving out of those cards. That's remarkable. So if you kept them all for yourself, you could be a little greedy. We, you know, this is a dream here. We're fantasizing. You could get, what, possibly 11, 12 months of driving with these $2,000 in gas gift cards. Or, again, you could give them out because there are 8 cards in $250 denominations. So either way, it's a fantastic thing. It's a fantastic prize. And, of course, you've already won because you are supporting New Hampshire Public Radio. Give us a call right now. Grab your raffle tickets. It just takes a couple of minutes. 1-888-805-6477 or go online to nhpr.org.
And there are just a few hours left in our early bird drawing, actually a couple of days. You have until noon this Saturday to put your name in the hat for $2,000 in gas gift cards. Raffle tickets are just $50 a piece. Pretty good return on your investment. Again, it just takes a couple of minutes on the phone with one of our great volunteers, or you can do it online, nhpr.org. And don't forget, the more tickets you purchase, the more chances you have to win one of 4 prizes. But again, noon Saturday deadline, do it now, 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
And we've been doing this for a while now, and you know, all of our past winners have something in common, and it's not the fact that they won, not just the fact that they won. They actually did it because they wanted to support New Hampshire Public Radio. They wanted to support The Exchange. They wanted to support Morning Edition and Diane Rehm. They wanted to support All Things Considered and all the shows they listen to on NHPR. They did it because they thought they were doing their part for their radio station. So why don't you step up, do that right now, become like them, become like our winners, and maybe we'll give you the prize as well, those $2,000 in gas gift cards or any one of the fantastic prizes, including the new car. 1-888-805-6477, 1-888-805-6477, or nhpr.org.
And you know, there are a couple of rules and regulations. Getting a raffle ticket is pretty easy, but you do have to be 18 years or older. You need to have a New Hampshire, Vermont, or Massachusetts mailing address. You cannot work for NHPR or be related to one of us, so Rick and I are out. And you've got to use your credit card. This is a short turnaround. We don't have time to send pieces of mail back and forth because we are going to announce the winner pretty soon after we have the deadline. So just a few criteria. There are a few more rules. You can find them online, nhpr.org, or just give us a call and get your raffle ticket now. Chances are pretty good that you qualify. 1-888-805-6477 is the number to call to buy your raffle tickets.
But the most important rule to remember right now is that this is over at noontime on Saturday. This is the early bird portion of the car raffle, which means if you want to get in the running for those $2,000 in gas gift cards, you need to do it right now. Give us a call at 1-888-805-6477. That's 1-888-805-6477. You can also go online, as Abby said, see all the rules and all the prizes at nhpr.org and get your raffle tickets that way. Either way, good luck.
This is NHPR. Coming up next hour on the Diane Rehm Show, the White House says it's starting to get ready for potentially painful year-end spending cuts. Debate over how this could affect the government and the economy. That's next hour on the Diane Rehm Show here on NHPR. New Hampshire weather today, partly sunny, warm, chance of an afternoon thunderstorm, highs 85 to 90 degrees. Partly cloudy, humid tonight, and low temperatures in the 60s. Tomorrow, mix of clouds and sunshine with a chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm, highs 85 to 90 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from School Spring, an online employment source connecting 21st century educators with New Hampshire schools. Information at schoolspring.com. And from the Scott Lawson Companies, protecting your company's most valuable asset, your people, through workers' comp, wellness, and health and safety services. HealthierWorkers.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at adaptation to climate change, what that means for our state, our communities, all of us as individuals, and why the whole idea of adaptation is an uncomfortable one for some. Join us with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. What are some of the practical ways that you've seen your own community trying to adapt to climate change, whether it's changes in building codes or how farmers operate or insurance rates going up for some people living in vulnerable areas? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Vicky Arroyo with the Georgetown Climate Center, I want to go back to you with an email that I got yesterday from Bruce in Londonderry. He says, first, we have extremists on both sides of this issue. We have some who claim our carbon dioxide emissions will cause us to be Venus. There are others who say global warming is a sham because winters are still cold and we get snow. He says, both are partly right and mostly overblown. He says there are climate cycles that go on this planet that have a wide variety of different lengths. He also says we've been pumping excessive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for 200 years, and it's entirely likely that excess carbon dioxide emissions are enhancing the underlying cycle. He concludes by saying the key point is that even if we have tipped the climate to runaway temperature increases, we probably won't see the end result for several hundreds of years. Should we reduce our profligate use of carbon-based fuels? Sure, he says. Should we eliminate all use of carbon-based fuels? No. Bruce says we should be a mixture of adapt and mitigate. And Bruce, thanks for the email. And Vicky, couple points there, but what about his final point? We should be a mixture of adapt and mitigate. Can we walk and chew gum at the same time?
Well, we have to. I mean, we're coping now with these changes, and it's sort of like pay now or pay later. You can adapt reactively, as my family did in the wake of Katrina, having lost their homes, or you can try to get ahead of it and say, okay, you know, what are our risks, not just from the traditional factors, river flooding there or loss of wetlands from other reasons, but also the fact that storm surge is going to be higher because sea level rise is higher and because the storms, as Cameron said, are getting more intense and have more precipitation attached to them. So we just really have to do both if we want to be smart about it. And I will say that while there have been natural cycles, we have a pretty good handle on what those cycles had looked like. And, in fact, we would really start to be heading into more of a cooling trend right now. But instead, we're breaking records now just this year at the rate of 10 to 1 warm records, heat records over cool records. And all of this, as Cameron said, was predicted because it's just simple physics. You take, you know, carbon out of the ground and you throw it into the atmosphere and you're really creating a blanket, if you will, that really has been in recent decades driven by human activity. And so we really do need to work on raising this issue with our politicians because there has to be mitigation as well as adaptation. And even on adaptation, frankly, the policies could be much better to promote adaptation. We work with a lot of communities who are telling us that it's not easy to build things differently because of the way the laws might be written or because of the way the federal funding flows, and you pretty much have to rebuild the same way that something was built before, even though they know it doesn't make sense. So I think really, you know, this is a time for all of us to really raise our voices and say, this is going to be the future. You know, it's not a great situation, but we can cope, but let's do it intelligently. And let the legislators hear from you, because what we hear is that when they go out to their constituents, this issue does not come up.
You know, that's really interesting.
People care, they need to let people know.
Given your family lives in New Orleans, right? I forgot about that, Vicky.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I have heard that the two industries that have been talking about adaptation for a long time, while everybody else is still, you know, debating and wondering, the insurance industry has been on board with this for a long time because they see huge payouts if sea levels rise and if the floods get really bad. And the construction industry, as you said. I wonder, though, Vicky, if local building codes and practices and so forth are keeping up with what the insurance industry and the construction industry are already knowing.
By and large, that's not happening, and that's what I'm saying. You know, a lot of the work that we do at our climate center at the law school is really looking at how communities can adapt, and, you know, do they need changes in their ordinances? Do they have the current authority? And we're often finding that they actually do have the authority, and, in fact, FEMA got some new authority to make some changes with this in mind as part of the new transportation bill. But whether or not they actually use their full authority, given that there are some political hurdles, frankly, to doing things differently. And you can imagine, it's easy for us to say, let's not let people rebuild in a floodplain. But if that's where somebody's lived for generations, they're not going to give up their land so easily.
Yeah,
that are very wrenching decisions involved.
That was the big decision. You know, people up here in New England said, why are those people returning to the Ninth Ward in New Orleans? Are they crazy? But people said, look, this is where my roots are. So it's easier said than done. You know, I'm interested, Cameron, in what Vicky said about, you know, some industries, some groups going, okay, we need to build better, do things better. So many decisions are made at the local level here in New Hampshire, a strong tradition of local control. So what do you see on the ground, Cameron, in terms of adaptation at the local level?
Well, I think there's a few shining examples here in New Hampshire. Keene, for example, several years ago actually developed an entire adaptation plan in light of changing climates. And, you know, they suffered some very serious flooding. And I think that really spurred them to action to say, how are we going to deal with this in the future? And they had a big study in collaboration with Antioch where they looked at one of the things is changing a lot of their culvert sizes. And that was one of the causes of that big flood. We've also had some really important action on the seacoast. As we've seen sea levels rising, there's the, you know, a story a month that comes out from Plum Island or our seacoast about sand washing away and houses falling into the ocean. And so the town of Seabrook, for example, is developing some new zoning around how buildings will be built in the future based on sea level rise up to 6 feet. And their approach is very interesting in that what we want to do is put those buildings that are most important in emergencies, like schools and police stations and fire stations, at a level that's much higher above sea level so we are sure that they are going to be available for us during disasters. Portsmouth right now is going through a process of looking at how vulnerable it is to sea level rise and what they might do to protect their significant assets. And I think this is a really important point, is a lot of the adaptation is going to happen on a municipal level. And so it's important for municipal representatives to begin this discussion by starting and saying, what's important to us? What's vulnerable to climate change? Where are we going to spend our money to protect what's really important to us? And that's a process that can eventually lead to this information and assessments being incorporated into their master planning. So as future town councils come in, they can see that the town's thought about this and that there's a plan for the future. It's not about fixing this tomorrow. It's about dealing with adaptation over the course of the next decade that we really have to focus on. And a lot of it, especially in New Hampshire, is going to be at the municipal level.
Wow. So lots of municipalities looking at this and going, all right, let's focus. If we're going to have droughts and floods and heat waves, what can we at least do to cope with that? You know what I'm interested from your angle, Steve Blackmer, is you've been working for the last 3 years on this idea of climate change adaptation at the spiritual level. This comes after a long career in the environment. And when I first heard about that, I thought, climate change and the church? I mean, what are you doing with this type of knowledge and your work now at St. Paul's Church?
Yeah, building, I think, off of just what Cameron said, starting with things that we love. What are the places that we love, that we care about, to recognize, as we said earlier, that some of those are going to be lost. Many of them are going to be lost. If we look at the impacts of climate change worldwide, it's going to be the poorest people everywhere who are going to feel the effects of that. The wealthy will have the resources to adapt easily. Air conditioners, move to a cooler climate, do, you know, all kinds of things. How do we open our hearts to the suffering that is absolutely going to occur by people who do not have the ability to run from it? How do we open our hearts to that? How do we look deep within ourselves at the spiritual resilience that enables us to respond? How do we find hope in the midst of suffering? We talked about Katrina in New Orleans. Where, you know, what's the resilience that occurs in those communities that enables people to come back, to survive, to adjust, to adapt? That's a deep spiritual practice. And I think in addition to looking at all of the other mitigation and adaptation, the technological fixes, there's a deep it's a very important part of this that requires that kind of transformation within each of us individually and within our society as a whole to enable us to deal with what's going to be some very difficult times.
Well, all of you, I really appreciate you being here. And Steve Blackmer, good to see you. Thank you for being
with us. My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, Steve Blackmer, longtime environmental professional in New Hampshire. Cameron Wake, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura.
Cameron Wake with UNH and Vicky Arroyo at the Georgetown Climate Center. Thank you also for your time and happy birthday.
Thank you. Have a good day.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in now with our summer car raffle.
Thank you, Laura. Welcome to New Hampshire Public Radio's summer car raffle, the early bird portion of the car raffle. I'm Rick Hanley alongside Abby Goldstein. We would love to hear from you right now and get your raffle tickets. 1-888-888-888. 805-6477. This is your chance to support NHPR and get entered to win these great prizes, including the new car and those $2,000 in gas gift cards.
1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org. So let me ask you a question. What condition is your car in? Is there a window problem, making funny noises? Maybe your brakes are squealing. Is your car so old that when you walk out of a shopping mall or a building and you see it in the parking lot, your heart sinks just a little bit at having to get into it? Maybe it still runs, but you just look at it and think, man, I wish I could have a new car.
Do you park it down the street in front of the neighbor's
house?
Yeah,
so people don't see it. But if you're a grand prize winner, you will get this new car. You can actually keep the new car for yourself and pass your old car on to somebody else or donate it to your favorite charity. Your automobile upgrade starts when you buy a couple of raffle tickets right now. And, of course, you'll be entering in to win the early bird prize, $2,000 in gas gift cards as well. 1-888-805-6477.
You just have a couple of days, really just hours left in this early bird period of our summer raffle. Saturday at noon is the deadline to buy your tickets and be eligible for the $2,000 in gas gift cards, in addition to being eligible for the car and the other prizes. So there isn't time to put off getting your tickets. You've been hearing about it for a while now throughout the summer. So if you've been meaning to do it, why wait any longer? This is the time to get those tickets. Now is the time to act. 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
And the Exchange is a marvelous program. You know that to be true because you listen to it every day, whether it's 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. Today's conversation, Adaptation to Climate Change, really compelling conversation. And, you know, there's a reason that you tune in regularly for the Exchange because you find it compelling and interesting and insightful, informative, and you have a chance to participate. And, you know, you have to know that the Exchange is listener supported. That means when you buy your raffle tickets today, you are helping to cover the cost of producing the Exchange every single day. So make that call right now. You could win a great prize, but really, when you buy raffle tickets, you're already a winner because you're supporting New Hampshire Public Radio. 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
And when you do call in to get those raffle tickets, you'll be talking to some great volunteers that are helping us in the phone room. Fred Carlson, John Vins, Glenn Kikirin, and Gene Rolsvig, all waiting for your call right now. Would love to hear from you at 1-888-805-6477. Or as Abby said, you can go online at nhpr.org, see the prizes, and get your tickets that way. So think about this, what you could do with those $2,000 in gas gift cards. Have you ever been to the Grand Canyon?
Nope.
What about Mount Rushmore?
Nope.
Yellowstone National Park?
Nope.
Well,
I guess I have some traveling to do.
Graceland in Memphis?
Nope.
Hmm.
I know.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I've been there.
All right. Well, there's one. But what about the others? Well, with those $2,000 in gas gift cards, Abby, well, you can't win them, of course, but the listener can go to any one of those places. You could go to there and back again.
Take pictures. And-